The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Kratosky, sounding happy. Because I think last week, Alex, or a few weeks ago, when we were recording the Bitcoin special, somebody commented on Twitter. Or no, actually somebody commented on the Guardian blog that I sound sad.
But they also called you the Kratosky.
The Kratosky. I think they may have spelled my name wrong, but you know what? That comes with part of the job. Anyway, this week on the show.
Good. It is very feasible to have a child who's come from a setting like this to go on and build the next Facebook, and their origins were from a refugee camp in Lebanon.
For Syrian refugee children, education is hope. I'll be speaking with James Cranwell Ward, Innovation Officer for UNICEF Lebanon, and Eliane Metney, Director of the International Education Association based in Beirut, about the role of DIY technologies like the Raspberry Pi in bringing that hope to children caught in chaos. Also, I'll be joined by the Guardian's tech team, you heard them before, to discuss the recent eBay hack and what you can do to protect yourself. Google talks about the future of ads on devices and washing machines and why the social app Foursquare has split in two. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm very happy to say that I'm joined by Guardian tech reporters Alex Hearn, Samuel Gibbs, and Guardian editor Charles Arthur. Welcome to the podcast, everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
Have I been promoted? I thought it was a technology editor.
I'm switching it around. We're mashing it up here. Yes, I have granted you the promotion, Charles. Congratulations. I'll give you a certificate later. Samuel, I want to kick off with a story that you've tracked. Last week, eBay announced that it had been hacked and it encouraged users to change their passwords. I got my email just yesterday on Monday bank holiday, though obviously the story broke across the network. I guess it was last week. They have, however, gone to great lengths to emphasize that no financial information was exposed, so bank account details or PayPal account details. However, names and addresses are also valuable information for hackers, are they not, Samuel? So how much did they manage to steal?
They certainly are. And to be honest, I think you're probably more worried about your stuff you can't change. Credit card, you can cancel that. You can get a new credit card. So how many people did it affect? Well, eBay won't say, but they have asked all 145 million active users across the globe to reset their password. And you're right, I only got my notification this morning.
I got mine last night. I was so thrilled.
You felt like part of the game.
I ignored it straight away.
It's like being part of a fan club, isn't it? A fan club of stolen data.
I got your warning and I came as soon as I wanted to.
But, the thing is, fine, change your password. That's great. And you must do that. And if you use that password on any other services, you must do that too. You must change your password. But the data that they've stolen is much more than just a password. It's, as you're right, it's your full name, because you have to have that on eBay. It's your email address, again, because you have to have that on eBay. Your physical address, because how else do you get things posted to you? Your phone number and your date of birth. So this is a whole treasure trove of information that basically an identity thief is, you know, salivating over the fact that they've basically now got you. That is all the information they really need to steal your identity.
It's interesting, actually. What they don't have is what something like a social network would offer, which is who you're connected with. And increasingly, aren't social networks and so-called social graphs being used to validate people's identities as well?
They certainly are. And with your name and your address, if you don't happen to have your security or privacy up to the max, you can easily find your Facebook profile. I mean, at one point, a database of users in the Asia-Pacific region was put online and purported to be from the eBay hack and for sale. Consulted a UK-based security company, and what they did was they went and found people that the names matched up to on Facebook. So that was validating the user. As it turns out, the data wasn't actually from eBay. It was fabricated from previous leaks and concatenated together to make it look like a new one. But the people are still real, and their information was perhaps real. So yes, I mean, you really do have this treasure trove of personal information that anybody who's set their mind to it can really steal your identity with.
Now, although we've only just heard about this, well, I say we've only officially just heard about it from eBay over the last couple of days. So we have a Saturday, we have a Tuesday, and we have a Monday. Alex, when did you hear?
I think I got mine on Sunday morning, but yeah. So this still is quite delayed.
End of May. I recall hearing that this happened in February, didn't it?
Yeah, so it's a rather complex one. The hack originated for eBay reckons between the end of February and the beginning of March. That was when one or two eBay employee identities were stolen. Now, nothing happened immediately as far as they were concerned. Those identities were stolen, and it wasn't until they were used to repeatedly try and access a database that they didn't have user authority to access that they were discovered to be stolen and actively being used. So that happened in May. So there was a gap between when the access was effectively granted to when it was discovered. And at some point in that mess, they got access to the complete user database.
I can only imagine like the hackers waking up every morning going, oh my God, they've totally got us today. No, they don't. Let's get more data. You know, I can imagine that this was the scenario that was playing out in their heads. Please, Alex.
What's really scary about eBay's slow reaction to all of this, of course, is that eBay isn't just eBay. eBay is PayPal. And in a way, it appears that we got lucky that it was the eBay half of the company that was hacked into. eBay's been mute on the whole thing, but they've not really given any indications that PayPal security is any better than eBay. And certainly some of the security flaws...
They have. So PayPal and eBay are firewalled between each other. The eBay employee IDs do not work on PayPal. They are physically separate. And all data secured with PayPal is all encrypted, so which it should have been on eBay, and loads of basically any security analyst worth their salt has been absolutely outraged that their personal data was not encrypted. Encrypt the passwords, yeah, fine, but all data everybody holds should be encrypted at all times. There's no reason for it to be unencrypted, left basically easy to steal.
But there are bizarre little security flaws that are shared by both PayPal and eBay. The big one that came to light on the day as a bunch of security analysts went to change their passwords is that both companies limit passwords to 20 characters and prevent you pasting in from elsewhere. I mean, the second one is because of the first one. If you have a 30-character password and try and paste it into a 20-character box, the last bit's curtailed and you don't know. But it's a worrying example of a company that isn't up to date with their security practices and yet has possibly the largest collection of linked bank accounts in the world.
Okay, so given that this is the scenario and given that we have all received our password protection, go back and change our passwords, what can we do to protect ourselves? Even in a system, say most systems are flabby, most systems are relatively weak. Security experts haven't yet got to all of the systems that they need to in order to say, bump everything up and make sure personal information is encrypted. So, you know, I go on to site X, it asks me for password. Sam, what can I do?
So for eBay users, basically look out for phishing attacks because they've now got your personal information. To try and stop other sites and services leaking your personal information, best thing to do is actually not to give it in the first place. For passwords, you should definitely have as strong a password as possible. Now, that's quite difficult because these days, you know, we're looking at, I mean, personally, I wouldn't look at a password under 20 characters, which is hilarious considering eBay doesn't let you have a password over 20 characters. But, you know, eventually, hopefully they will. But, you know, it should be complex. It should have numbers, letters, capitals, special characters. It should be a nice complex mix and it hopefully shouldn't be a dictionary word. So even if it's in what used to be called leet speak, that's still a guessable word by algorithmic states. And quite a lot of these password breakers, all you do is you brute force it. You just fire a fast computer at it and it keeps on entering passwords until it gets it right. So nice strong password is the first. And to make it easier to remember these, I suggest using a password manager. There are lots around. Lots of them are very, very good, secure. And, you know, as long as you have a really bulletproof password to get into them and activate the two-factor authentication, then you're more secure than you are likely to be trying to use the same password on everything.
Well, absolutely. And I, you know, I'm as guilty as many people, I'm sure, who are listening, which is I have been flabby, I have been lazy. And for a very long time, I used exactly the same password or variations on a theme across all of my online accounts, because frankly, I have enough to think about and I couldn't remember which iteration of what it was and et cetera. So how, apart from password managers, and I'd love to hear a little bit more, Charles, I know that you want to jump in as well. How to construct something so that I actually know what password goes into which thing without referencing a password manager, Charles?
So a tip I was given by Neil Barrett, who's a security researcher who did a lot of great work some years ago, was that when you're asked to give a password at a site, and it's a new site when you're registering, you use something from the name of the site and you mix it up with your own special recipe that you use for websites. So perhaps you add some punctuation mark and some other characters plus the name of the site. And then whenever you come back to that site, you go, oh my God, what's my password? You'll be able to say, oh, okay, so what I do is I just take the name of the site, I add my special recipe, and that's my password. And the other thing is that it means you're not using the same password anywhere. You can remember it. Other people won't be able to work out what it is. You can use different strengths of recipe. You might add sort of two punctuation marks rather than one if you need an extra strength one. And that means that, for your banking site, you might use something where you vary the recipe slightly, and your PayPal site, you vary it again. But in each case, you're able to remember it. But at the same time, you're not using the same one. So even if someone was to break the passwords, unhash them from whatever encryption was used, they get it and they go and try it on a different site. Doesn't work.
Samuel, do we have on the Guardian site, do we have recommendations for password managers, et cetera?
We do. Following on from a couple of email hacks, we wrote what to do and how to protect yourself. We've also recently written, following on from the eBay, what you can do to protect yourself from all that personal information, suggestions of things like, don't give your full address. If a site asks for your address but it's never going to post you anything, give an address two streets down or something like that. They're only trying to locate you. Use multiple emails. Fudge your birth date, for instance. Why should you give your real birth date if they're just looking for an age? Pick a date you really like. I don't know, like 02/02/2002 or even 20/02/2002. Depends on how old you want to be, but
All of this, as just a quick final thought, all of this is really interesting because basically we're undermining the systems that most of these services use to monetize us, to get advertising to us, to actually service us. And so we've got a real conflict here, don't we, between what we need to, how we need to protect ourselves and what these sites actually want from us so that they can better serve us. How do we deal with this conflict, Samuel?
I mean, until basically the most secure services that we have, banks and credit cards, until they have some other way of authenticating you, we're going to have to go down this route because they use this personal information that's meant to be secret to verify you are who you say you are. There's got to be another method, maybe biometrics.
Charles, very quickly.
Quite an interesting contrast to the whole eBay thing of taking a couple of months. Spotify's just put out a notice where they're saying that their evidence shows one Spotify user's data was accessed. And this didn't include any password, financial or payment information. But even so, they're going to ask some Spotify users to re-enter their username and password over the coming days. Quite proactive.
There you go. Best practice or perhaps hypersensitive to what's going on at the moment. For the latest on the eBay story and for top tips, head to theguardian.com/technology. There was a time in tech a long, long time ago, around 2010, 2011. Can you remember that? That every tech-savvy person decided to download the Foursquare app and publish their exact location and movements to the world. Or at least the rest of their extended network. Of course, all good ideas are copied, and so this check-in function turned up as part of your Facebook or other social network apps and services. But this week, Foursquare has announced that they're rethinking what they do. An identity crisis. I love those. And Alex Hearn, you met up with Foursquare founder Dennis Crowley in their New York headquarters when you were over in the US last week. Tell me a little bit about what happened with Dennis.
Yeah, so basically Foursquare is, and has been for quite a long time, stuck in this bind where when they launched in 2009, the world was quite a different place. Mobile internet was still vaguely new. Smartphone apps were very new. And so there were things that you could just do that had never been done before, checking in being one. The whole concept of tying your activity online to where you physically were was a brand new and enthralling idea. So Foursquare came out with this check-in concept, the idea that you go, you're in a place, you tell Foursquare you're in a place, and it tells your friends the same thing. It then layered on this fun gamification aspect, another thing that was new and cool in 2009. So you would get points for checking in. If you checked in at a certain place enough, you could become the mayor of it. You'd show off to your friends about how many points you had, where you were the mayor of, you'd win badges, all of this. That was briefly popular. And then slowly people realized that maybe they didn't want to broadcast their location anywhere full stop. Maybe they didn't want to check in at Tesco and Sainsbury's. They certainly didn't care about gamification. And so the use of Foursquare and checking in services like that slowly petered off.
I feel a bit sad now because I was quite late to the Foursquare game and I've never been the mayor anywhere. I'm still trying to be the mayor of London St. Pancras International, but okay, fine.
But the problem that Foursquare have is that they themselves actually pivoted away from that quite a long time ago. What they found is that they have now 5 years' worth of users telling them, I am in this place, and then I went to this place, and then I went to this place. And so they, doing fairly rudimentary data mining, actually, can start to see that someone who checks into these douchey coffee shops also checks into these hipster clothes shops.
You follow me. We're friends on Foursquare, Alex. I'm actually mortified now that you're exposing so much about me.
I meant any hypothetical user might go to douchey coffee shops. But yeah, so they've got this. And what Foursquare, the app, has morphed into is a really rather good alternative to apps like Google Maps or Yelp for just letting you find a place nearby that you might want to go to. You're in a new part of town and you want coffee. You're in a new country and you want food from home. Something like that.
I have actually, in many, many countries, used Foursquare almost exclusively to figure out where it is that I should go. But actually with greater or lesser degrees of success, primarily based upon how saturated the country is with Foursquare. So, for example, in the US, as you may have found when you were in the US last week, it's kind of like the home sharing system Airbnb, where suddenly everybody seems to have got into it. It's become very commercialized. Whereas, say, here or some of the other places where it's got a good buoyant community, it's not as saturated and therefore people aren't trying to exploit it as much.
Right. It's better and worse. And this is the problem with them relying on fundamentally user-generated data. But the problem they have right now is that no one's even willing to give it a try. Foursquare is, to them, still this check-in service. And so earlier this month, they did what is basically a last-gasp attempt to regain this, regain the forefront of tech trends. And they took the check-in stuff, all of the check-in stuff, and moved it to another app. So they've launched this new app called Swarm, which is there if you're still one of the people who likes the checking in thing on Foursquare, and actually makes it a bit more relevant again. It brings the meeting up with friends aspect to the forefront, does away with most of the gamification entirely, and turns it into, you know, what Foursquare was in 2009, the concept that you can check into a bar. If a friend's in the bar next door, you're not going to pass like ships in the wind. You'll see each other, and that could be quite nice. But if it's not nice, and if that sounds horrific to you, which it does to a lot of people, you don't have to use it. And the Foursquare app is now this thing which is there to let you find good things nearby. The interesting thing, of course, is that in tacitly admitting that their brand is a bit tarnished by the check-in thing, they're nonetheless trying to recover that brand, and they've created a whole separate thing. Personally, I would have gone the exact opposite way. I'd have given Foursquare up for lost, created a nice new brand for the thing that they're actually really good at that people like, and then called Swarm Foursquare and Foursquare cool new brand X.
But at the same time, they are very good at what they do. They do have a kind of qualitative effect on pointing you in the right direction of the types of things. Why are they so good?
it's all in the data. I mean, Foursquare has had 5 years of people actively and deliberately reporting their locations back to them. That's actually even more than, you know, a data miner like Google, who own the Google Latitude product, but it's never been really as heavily used as Foursquare, and certainly not, and this is something that I think is quite important, not used in as notable a way. Most of the places that check on locations do it passively. They sit in the background and they listen to you because you installed an app that lets them do it. Or like Google Maps, they'll look at your location when you open them, but that might not have any real relevance to what you want to do or find. The thing about Foursquare is because you only check in when you're somewhere that you planned to be, wanted to be, and kind of want to show off that you're there, they've got this whole new layer of what the music service This Is My Jam called Notable Data. So they're not having to deal with the cruft of, oh, well, this person was, oh, on the road between two places. Well, that's a useless data point. And this person was, oh, well, they were doing their laundry. That's a pretty useless data point. They only have information that people actually thought was important enough to share. So they have a very high quality database, which when you're using it and when you're using it in a city that has that requisite baseline, can work.
Are there black holes? Are there any places that really haven't gone there, that haven't really adopted, that are better served by systems like Google Maps or Yelp or any of the others?
There are black holes, obviously. It's primarily popular in the English language world, and, you know, anywhere you go where smartphones themselves haven't really taken off, Foursquare has a paucity of data. But at the same time, in those black holes, there's not much for them to compete with. You know, Yelp is also user-driven. Google is, well, most of their information is vaguely user-driven. And in places, Google's maps are good, but maps won't give you recommendations. Maps will simply tell you the nearest thing, which is what a yellow phone book could have done 30 years ago. So I think they're in a good position. The other interesting thing, of course, it's a completely separate trend that Foursquare's doing, is doubling down on single-purpose apps. So just like Facebook released the Paper app, just like Google has been steadily splitting all of their services into separate apps for everyone, and Dropbox releasing their Carousel app for photos and bringing in Mailbox for email, Foursquare has sat back and said, you know what, people on mobile phones don't like one app that does everything. They like one app that does one thing. Even if it comes from the same company, even if they're very heavily integrated, one icon on one home screen should do one thing. Should check in if you're on Swarm, it should tell you where you're going if you're on Foursquare, and that's it. And I think that's going to be a trend that we'll see as we go forward. Mobile phones aren't very good for multitasking.
Very interesting. Well, I'm sure we'll come back to this trend, if only just to say, ha ha ha, you were right stroke wrong. Thank you very much for that, Alex. And you can find out more about Swarm and Foursquare at theguardian.com/technology. This week, Google raised a few financial models for their increasing suite of connected devices. These are the objects that are traditionally called the Internet of Things, mundane stuff that, when networked, seem to take on a whole new life of their own. Now, Charles, one of the things that Google spoke about was Nest, the power company that's created smoke alarms and thermostats that intelligently learn your behavior and feed that back to you and to your house. Can you remind me what Nest's relationship with Google is?
Google bought Nest earlier this year for $3.2 billion. Now, the financial models that it was talking about, which was to, it said, it was explaining why it wasn't going to break out its mobile ad revenue in its quarterly results. It's not going to break out mobile revenue as against desktop revenue. And the reason it gave was, well, you know, how do you define mobile? You know, why should we limit it just to that? Is a tablet mobile? Do people use them more like desktops? And also, it said, we foresee ads being used. And this was a filing it made in December, so this is before it bought Nest. It said, you know, we foresee ads appearing on refrigerators, car dashboards, thermostats, you know, all sorts of places. So, of course, when this filing was made public, which happened a sort of week or so ago, people said, thermostats? You own a company that makes thermostats. And so both Tony Fadell, who's the founder of Nest, and who had previously said, we're not going to change our privacy policy, even though we're owned by Google, both Fadell said, no, that, you know, we're totally not into doing ads on our products. And Google also said, no. When we said thermostats back in December, we didn't mean thermostats like the ones that we own.
And we so were talking about fantasy thermostats.
Well, yeah, and maybe other people's. So it was... it was sort of an interesting sort of moment. But it's quite interesting that that is how Google is sort of trying to, A, say, you know, mobile, well, you know, what does mobile mean? Why do we have to do this? So you could sort of see the SEC might say, okay, mobile, they're the things that you hold in your hands. They're mobile phones. And, you know, everything else, just call that under an other. You know, and the SEC still has the power actually to come back and say to Google, yeah, we think you should break it out further, you know, say desktop, mobile, other. They could still do that, but that fridge. Hasn't happened yet.
Desktop, mobile, other, fridge.
Well, yeah, it's to inform investors. You know, is Google's desktop revenue going up or down? Is mobile revenue going up or down? Facebook breaks it out in that way, and it's not as if Facebook doesn't appear in lots of different places. So that was interesting for that. And, you know, the idea of Nest showing ads, people went, whoa, don't like that. And it was really quite a strong reaction, which is part of why I think Google was quite quick to say, no, that was all theoretical.
It's an interesting issue, isn't it? Because we have these science fiction fantastical scenarios in which we're walking through public places and ads are beamed at us from billboards, etc., that are relevant.
Minority Report.
Exactly,
sort of, yes.
Exactly. Or Blade Runner, go even further back. But in our home, we have this sense that the technology that we invite into our home is under our control, whether it's a Roomba gone mad or whatever. It's still under our control, and we don't actually want the external overlords, God, I'm really going dystopic here, the external overlords to use their access to our systems to beam information. And this is even more relevant now that we're starting to hear other things. Like Charles, today on the site, you wrote about Apple Home. So we're starting to see these large corporations coming into our homes and potentially seeing, as Google filed recently, seeing these devices as places through which they can make money, that they can make revenue by showing us advertising.
Sure. I mean, Apple, the FT reported that Apple is going to announce a sort of smart home platform at its Worldwide Developers Conference, which is in a week's time, and that this will be a way of connecting all sorts of smart devices, so smart lights, perhaps smart fridges, if they ever come along, smart dishwashers, washing machines, you know, alarm systems. So the idea is that Apple seems to want to do that. Though Apple, the FT is saying, and it sort of fits with other things I've been hearing from within Apple, would be emphasizing the idea that they wouldn't be collecting data about you, that it's all just, they'd sort of make sure that everything's working, but they're not looking to profile you. They're not looking to capture information about you. And that's their way of trying to differentiate themselves from Google and from Facebook, is to put a big emphasis on, we're not about data collection. I mean, it's interesting that there is a device that pretty much everyone has in their home, which beams adverts at you a lot of the time, and which people look at a lot of the time, called a television. But that's sort of done on sort of understanding. And yet, at the same time, we don't like the idea that a thermostat might show us an advert. It's quite an interesting sort of difference in thinking.
I think possibly because it's a passive entity. I don't want to walk into my kitchen, which is where my thermostat is. And that's where my connected fire alarm is. Oh my God, I've invited them into my house everywhere. My dog even has a quantified self thing on his neck. Poor little guy. It's on his collar. I haven't implanted it in under his skin.
Quantified id, it must be, if it's a dog.
Yeah, very good. Quantifido.
I think people will put up with more than you think they will. I mean, you've only got to look at, say, put it this way. You pay money for pay TV, yet you're still showing adverts. I mean, if you look at Sky's ad revenue model, it makes quite a lot of money from adverts, and arguably perhaps your pay TV would be more if they didn't have any adverts, but you're still paying a considerable amount of money. It's not cheap. And then you're forced to watch adverts, or you skip them with your PVR box, whichever you try.
Well, what is also interesting is not just these devices that are connected to the external systems, you know, the external overlords, as I am now going to call them, but also other things. So, for example, in the UK, we've got quite a buoyant and homegrown Internet of Things community that's caught the attention of Prime Minister David Cameron a few months ago. So we've got innovations like Goodnight Lamp, which is for long-distance couples, by inventor Alexandra Deschamps-Lancino, and mundane systems like London-based design company Berg's Cloud Wash. That was a difficult one to say. Anyway, which is a connected washing machine app. And Sam, we were talking earlier about this item, and you mentioned LG has a washing machine app as well.
More than that, it's Home Chat. You can basically talk to your home appliances as if you were talking to your kid or your friend via the age-old text mechanism. So you can basically text your washing machine and go, "Hey, what's up?" And it'll go, "Oh, I'm on the spin
chilling
cycle. I'm almost done. I'm almost done." You know, I mean.
And then we've also got examples of, for example, homes that tweet, and you know, all of the connected devices. So here we have, we do have an Internet of Things experience, a connected technology experience. But by throwing advertising into the mix, Charles, is home the next battleground? Is you know, are the walls of our home the next battleground when it goes just beyond Cloud Wash sending me a message saying, "Shall I delay for a half an hour before I do the rinse cycle?"
Oh yeah, clearly. I mean, I think it's very much that these big companies, Apple, Google, and actually Microsoft, all want to be the ones that drive the connected home. And Microsoft for years hoped that the Xbox would be the way through which it did this. And if not the Xbox, then maybe the media server. But the Xbox has sort of just become a games console, and the media server has just died a quiet death, really.
Well, we shall follow the connected home as it wanders around the internet talking to itself at theguardian.com/technology. Over the last year, more than 300,000 children have crossed the border from Syria to Lebanon, escaping the civil war that rages in their home country. Many of these kids have been left on their own by their parents, who feel that their futures in Syria are unsafe and uncertain, that they'll fare better in Lebanon. Yet what the children find in the refugee camps is a grim introduction to the unimaginable realities of a displaced life. One of the features of their new unpredictable future is a total absence of education. When I was in the country recently, I learned of several Lebanese and international initiatives to tackle this problem, including one innovative lesson spearheaded by the International Education Association and UNICEF to teach these kids to code. It's not just the future-proofing life skill that's remarkable about this project. The project's leaders, James Cranwell Ward and Elian Metney, are using the British computing success story Raspberry Pi to realize their vision. I spoke with Elian and began asking what the project is and how it started.
I just received an email a couple of years ago by somebody called Candace Johnson. And she said, "Well, I got your email from De Vag in Holland, and I was very interested in promoting this Raspberry Pi in the Middle East, and they told me that you're the person I should contact. Are you interested in hearing about it?" And so I had a very long Skype conversation with her. I think it was like 2 years ago. And her interest was to have this for women in rural areas to help development and to help them improve their lives, their entrepreneurial skills. And I said, "Well, you know, I need to, of course I'm interested. I think it's an amazing tool. It sounds amazing." I looked around a little bit online, and I said, "I'd like to receive get a device and play with it for a while before deciding and saying how we could use it." And so she sent the devices, and I started communicating with the folks in Cambridge and saying, "How could this really be used with women?" And it was very hard to imagine this with adults before thinking of it with kids. And I was, what kind of applications would work? And they were interested in other countries. And I said, "My sense is, let's try with kids in school, see how they react to it. Let's start and see how this would work. What type of applications, programs, energy comes around it, and then we can build on that experience." And we did. We gave it a try here, and the amazing part was that it was very well received by the telecom minister, who promoted it and invested personal funds into buying the first 50 Pis to come to Lebanon. And introduced it with the Ministry of Education. And so we were very lucky to have this pilot start in a school, because they had the vision that if this works, the mayor then said, "If that works in a school, then we'll buy a Pi against every pi that's invested, and we want our kids to have skills for 21st century, for the 21st century.
What was the leap then from taking it from schools within the Lebanese system, whether private or public, to then taking it to the refugee camps?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because as we were doing the pilot, I went back to the school trying to see what are they doing with the pie, how they were using it. And at the same time, I was contacted I was following up with the same group, and I happened to meet James in an international call about what we could do for refugees. And I said, well, we need to think about what we can do. We can use technology to reach the largest number of people, and so that and try and be imaginative with it rather than just choose regular. They were speaking about a tablet, and I was mentioning the Pi, and James said, "Well, you're using the Pi." And James was there were 10 people on the call. I had no clue who James was, and he was amazed that this was happening in a school here. It was just coincidence. And he said, well, you're in Lebanon? And I said, who are you? And he was like, I'm working at UNICEF Innovation. And I was like, the next day we just met, and we clicked on what is the potential with that technology. And we could see eye to eye that it's an opportunity to reach out to more, but it's in the way you reach out. It's providing the opportunity for people to build their knowledge, not just receive information. Because the trend is just to give the tool or content, but what do you do with it? And that provides you the opportunity to do something meaningful, to construct your knowledge with it. And that's where we started exploring those possibilities.
Now, we know how you ended up bringing the Raspberry Pi to Lebanon and to Lebanese schools and even to the refugee camps. But there are other systems that are out there that could potentially do similar, if not the same things. Why did you actually decide that the Raspberry Pi was the best technology for this task?
Well, I think one of the things that is very attractive with Raspberry Pi is that it is open source, and there's a huge community out there working on it. It's not only one person working on it or a small number. The community is big, and it's supportive. And that's very important when you're developing any tool in technology. Having a community that is driving behind it, if you need anything, the energy, the buzz is out there, and people want it to move forward. And it's already going into the development world. There are areas in Africa where they're using it. In the Middle East, it's probably the first. But in Africa, it's been used extensively. And what I really like about, personally, the Pi is the people behind it. The community is very important in anything you do in technology.
Eliane, have you experienced or have you witnessed any resistance to this project, to bringing Raspberry Pi and Scratch, to teaching these Syrian refugee children how to code?
I've faced resistance not now, but 2 years ago. And when I brought this piece, I did try in several places, and I would hear things like putting that piece in the hands of kids, it could be really messy. What would they do with it? So if people don't know something, they resist it, and that's normal. But when they see positive results and being organized into what you can do with it, if they have the organizational tools and procedures to work with it, then there's no reason for them to resist it. I've seen a lot of excitement after the Durashwer event, where they can see that kids can really move forward with it.
Eliane mentioned her partner in crime on this project, James Cranwell Ward. He's from UNICEF, and I delved into more about the project with him. James, tell me about the origin story of working with Eliane and how you decided that bringing Raspberry Pi and even the Scratch programming language to Syrian refugee children was a good idea.
Myself and Eliane, we were looking at the same kind of problem in parallel, but without knowing that each of us were doing it. And in a place like Lebanon, where we don't have the same problems that we might have in other countries that UNICEF is present. I mean, we have electricity here. We can have blackouts, but it's more or less constant. We also have network as well. We have good network. So I couldn't really understand why we weren't looking at projects like this, why we weren't looking at using, you know, cheap hardware and see what we can deliver in terms of educational benefit at a very low price point. And I chose the Raspberry Pi because of its community, because I've worked with it before, and because there already was a lot of software and content produced for it. And then I kind of was thinking, okay, now how can I package this? It's all very well just delivering technology and expecting it to work. It needs to be delivered in a way that is guided and is simple to understand. So I built some prototypes, and I went to meet with some suppliers while I was in London on, you know, how can we package something together at a very good price that we can roll out to do e-learning activities on.
How many children are affected by this? How many children are you able to actually touch with this technology?
Like with anything, we need to have concrete results against this. So we you know, what we have is a proposal. What is amazing for me is that I found Eliane in Lebanon already, who's been doing this with the school. So we have concrete evidence of this working. And now we're going to package up the same ideas along with the training and see what we can do in the refugee setting for this summer for 3 months. Based off the back of that, based off our findings, we've been very careful about where we've chosen to implement. We want to implement in areas where we can reach easily and that we know can work. And then from there, we're going to scale out, as you say, to the rest of the refugee population, which at this point is over 300,000.
As I asked Eliane, as I mentioned to Eliane, the choice of Scratch has with it, you know, some particular assumptions about how kids learn, why kids are learning, and what it is that you want to, the kinds of logic that you're trying to get out of kids. So what else are you actually teaching these kids by using Scratch other than simply the ability to program?
So the way we're using Scratch in this program is to teach children about their human rights and also issues that affect them. So what myself and Eliane are working on is courses designed around Scratch. So, I mean, we're using Scratch as a vehicle because it's on the Pi and it's well understood. But we'd like to get children to make games or programs or animations around, for example, learning to prevent polio. What can you do to prevent yourself being caught by polio, which is an issue here that we're working on to make sure that polio doesn't seep into Lebanon. Also, issues such as water sanitation. You know, why is it important to wash my hands after I go to the toilet? Why is it important to source clean water and manage water in a way that it doesn't get contaminated? Also, issues of safety. You know, how through teaching and learning Scratch, you can teach a child about staying safe in all kinds of ways, from being safe from violence, from abuse, and other problems that can arise when you have a refugee situation like this. So it's being really used as a vehicle, and ultimately it's fun. I mean, these children, they don't have anything else. I mean, a lot of them are out of school, which means they don't have access to any kind of education. So it's fun, it's engaging for them, which is great for us, and it also is teaching them skills that can then be applied when hopefully this refugee situation will end, and we'll teach them about rights that they as a child are entitled to.
As you know, in the UK, this is nominally the year of code, and so there's a motivation, a push to try and get coding in schools, but it's also been met with resistance because people say, well, you know, we've got other things that we need to teach kids. Obviously, in a refugee situation, there are a lot of other things to teach kids. So why teach them to code? Why is this now an important life skill that you need to bring to this incredibly fractious border?
I mean, as you know, working in technology yourself, the rate at which technology is being rolled out into our lives is phenomenal. And I think that coding, the understanding of technology and how to manipulate it, is going to be a core component of our lives and our children's lives going forward. what excites me about bringing an initiative like this into a curriculum is that you could potentially have you've got a set of children all over the world learning the same skills. I mean, the Raspberry Pi allows us to standardize somewhat what they can learn, and it's not just refugee children that have access to this technology now, but it's also children in the first world and in Europe and the USA. They'll be on an equal footing, more or less. I mean, it could never be completely equal, but we're enabling the same tools in the round to all children equally as much as we can. Imagine the story in a few years' time that, you know, we could, and it's very feasible to have a child who's come from a setting like this to go on and build the next Facebook or Twitter or, huge technical empire, and their origins were from a refugee camp in Lebanon. That's a very far and somewhat rosy kind of view of what the potential is, but it's really not out the realms of possibility.
Thanks to James Cranwell Ward and Elian Metney. That's it for the podcast this week. I'd like to thank our guests and our tech team. Tech Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps and presented by me, Alex Kratosky. Come back next Wednesday for more.
Bye. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.